So it looks like in every one of our services, we've kind of broken things down just about that way, with really the vast majority of people saying that when it comes to how people are getting along these days, we are deeply divided and fractured. So that's pretty good evidence that we have forgotten how to get along. I mean, it's happened that way in each of our services. Is that fair to say? We have forgotten how to get along. Okay, so lots of things we can talk about here, but there is evidence in this world that we could do better. We're not getting along well. Now, when I speak of evidence, let's just start with this. In the late 1800s, to mid 1900s, there was a fellow by the name of Edmond Locard. Edmond Locard, let's just talk a little bit about crime science now and evidence. Edmond Locard had something that developed that he called the Locard principle. And so when you see the Locard principle, it's actually an exchange principle is what it was. And this guy was known as the Sherlock Holmes of France. He really was kind of the person that started forensic science. Really smart guy. But the thing here is that he says every contact leaves a trace. So what's happening, like if there's a crime and you're in a crime scene, there's an exchange that happens. So you know how this works. I mean, you watched like CSI with Grandma or NCIS or one of those EIEIO shows on CBS. So you know you're a crime expert. But here it is. If you break into some place, if a criminal breaks in, all of a sudden there's a contact that has now happened, and that contact will leave a trace. There's an exchange that has happened. Maybe it's a fiber from his coat. Maybe it's a little blood because he got cut as he went in. It's hair. It's DNA, it's mud from his boot, it's something, but now he has left a trace at the crime scene. What Locard would also say is that if you get there quick enough and you catch him, that exchange is leaving evidence on him as well. There's a little mud on his boot. There's a little glass shard on his sweater. You know how that works. There's an exchange principle. Every time there's a contact leaves a trace. Well, there you go. I just wanted you to know that. So now let's go on ahead and go. No. Just put a flag in that and we'll come back to it, okay? There is evidence out there that we have forgotten how to get along. And I don't know why that is. Is it because there are 7.5 billion of us on the planet now? Is it because we are more connected than ever before through technology, but we're also like more divided and the noise is getting louder? Is it because there seem to be fewer and fewer things that you can talk about safely with other people? And I'm like talking around the dinner table. There's like a list of restricted topics with most people. It's like, don't bring that up. Do you understand what I'm saying? Lean over to the person next to you very quickly and say, yep, this is a restricted topic in our house. You just don't bring this up. You don't bring this up at work. You don't bring this up. Go ahead. Just tell somebody next to you. I'm not asking you to have the conversation. Just tell them what's an off-limits thing. While they're doing that, I'm just going to talk to you guys who are in the hub, those of you who are with us online everywhere, those of you who are at the sites. So we're really glad you're here. All right. Let's come back. We started a series last week where we said we're going to reimagine what God can still do in our lives. We're going to rethink. We're going to reconsider. We're going to really try hard to use words that start with re for the rest of this series. And today it's remember. We're going to remember some things. But I told you last week that it's all based on the foundation of truth. And we start up some questions, and we'll come back to some of those questions after Easter, okay? Well, technically, after Easter, we're going to enter into a series on forgiveness. Not that anybody here needs that. Like, how do you receive it? How do you ask for it? And wait for it. How do you give forgiveness? Yeah, so that's after Easter. But after that, we're going to start a series called, and I always have to think about this, A and Q. Which just seems awkward to say. It seems awkward to look at it that way. But oftentimes we hear answers from people, like maybe it's well-meaning parents, it's teachers. We hear answers from Scripture. But those answers then stir up other questions. Well, we're going to acknowledge that, take a look at that, see if we can pursue some truth together. We'll admit what we don't know. But that's all in the spring. When it comes to evidence right now, let me just say this. Matt and I talked about this last week, but this is not an anti-intellectual faith. There is an evidential nature to the Christian faith, which means there's all sorts of resources that we can offer you and give you and books that we can point you towards and things at our bookstores. Take explorations. That's such a helpful class. But I want you to now enter into something with me and see if our imaginations can be stirred up. We're going to go back to one of those gospels that are reliable. In fact, the manuscript evidence is embarrassingly rich. What we're reading is what John wrote. And John is an eyewitness who has an up-close and personal sort of a story to tell of the life of Jesus. So we're going to go back now to a foundational text for this church, for me personally, for our classes. You hear it in classes. You'll hear it at Body Life. You'll hear it at, we keep spinning up Body Life classes all the time. It's really cool. We don't just do one a semester now. So come on, join us. Body Life Vision Dinner, books. I mean, this is kind of a big deal for us. And hopefully in the coming minutes, you'll begin to understand why it's a big deal to Jesus. And if it's a big deal to Jesus, it ought to be a big deal to you. As you're turning to John chapter 17, what I would like to do, if you'd allow me to, is to tell you one more time about the worst night in somebody else's life. Now, the emotions are really high at this point in the room because everyone senses something. They can't really keep up with what's happening. They're barely understanding what's going on in their hearts. The host is as warm and as gracious as ever, but you can tell there's a kind of a thickening sadness that is now sort of surrounding him and encircling him. You could tell it was going to be one of those kinds of nights for Jesus. In the middle chapters of the Gospel of John, let's say 13 through 17, a lot is happening. It describes the worst night of Jesus' life. Now, by the time we get to chapter 17, a whole bunch of things have happened. I mean, to be honest with you, the meal that would have already meant something to these people, the Passover meal, is now drenched with new meaning because this one that they trust, this one who is leading them through the meal, is acting as if death is waiting for him outside the door. And if you read the rest of the story, it was. You see, they've been told for a long time now that a cross was waiting for Jesus at the end of this last visit to Jerusalem, but they never really fully believed it. At the beginning of John 13, there are these comments, this exchange back and forth between Judas the betrayer and Jesus, and they're like words slice the air, and nobody really gets it. There's this cryptic, symbolic gesture that happens between Judas and Jesus, and only the two of them really know what's happening, and I think it's right there. This is just Greg talking. That Jesus looks one more time at this man he had invited to be a disciple with a look that even if Judas ignored it, must have broken the heart of heaven. Does this have to happen? The betrayer is dismissed from the table, and now it will happen. The unholy kiss, the unjust arrest, the beatings, the blasphemy, the bloody cross, it's all going to happen, and really soon. So what does Jesus do right before all hell breaks loose? Well, John tells us that he showed these disciples, the remaining disciples, the full extent of his love. Now, many of your translations will put it differently. It will say that he loved them to the last, or he loved them to the end. That's it. He loved them to the end. You see, even when this now begins to unfold and the storm clouds begin to gather, Jesus is taking care of his disciples. He's telling them things that they'll need to survive in the coming days. It's his heart that's breaking, but he's giving them help. If you go back and you read these middle chapters, by the way, if you're enjoying Proverbs, well, okay, now try this. Just chapters 13 through 17 in John. Go back and be shocked by how powerful the language is in those chapters. You will see verses and hear words. You'll be amazed at how much is jammed in there. But remember the context. This is the worst night of Jesus' life, and he's serving his disciples. He's loving them to the end. So what do you say when there's nothing left to say? Or maybe there's nothing else that their hearts can handle. What does Jesus do? He prays. Now, we don't really know where this prayer happens or when this prayer happens, but if you look at I think it's verse 31 of chapter 14, what you will see is that a conversation that started around that table now leaks out into the streets because Jesus, the rabbi, is now on the move again. And these disciples are going to keep up with him the way they had for almost 3 years. They're mimicking every move. They're listening. They're trying to catch everything. But tonight, it seems different. Tonight, there's like this shadow across his face. Tonight, when they step out into the streets, it feels less safe than it has ever felt. Go to the companion gospel in Luke, and Jesus says, "Are any of you armed?" It's really a tense time. They're walking through the streets, and it's like you feel darkness trying to find them, and eventually it does. someplace between the upper room and the Garden of Gethsemane, which faces the city of Jerusalem. John tells us that Jesus looks heavenward and prays, Father. Now, gang, the thread holding all of this together is the relationship between the Son and the Father. There's a love there that you and I don't fully understand. Father, Abba, that's a good Aramaic word. Papa, it's here, the time has come. What does that mean? It means that nothing that is now about to happen was out of Jesus' control. Nothing shocked him. There's nothing here where he's going, uh-oh, this thing just got out of hand and I don't know what to do with it. They both knew all the prophecies, all the plans before the foundations of the earth. They knew this was going to happen. In fact, if you read the Gospel of John, Jesus talks about it throughout the gospel. At one point, his mom, just being mom, tries to nudge her son and say, why don't you just tell people, show them where you are. And he rather bluntly looks at her and says, it's in the Greek, that's what it means. That's what it is. It's, yeah. There she is in her Carolina blue and he looks at her and so it's not time yet, mom. It's not time, but now it is. The Father and the Son know that it has now all come down to this. That grand hymn that we read together from Philippians 2, it says that this Son became obedient even unto death, even the death on a cross. Well, we're there. Why? For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son. Surely that's true. There's a whole bunch of us that believe that. Not all of you, but a bunch of us that believe that. What does that mean? It means that God isn't just loving, God is love. 1 John 4:8 says that God is love. By definition, his essence is love. You want a fancy term? Ontologically speaking, God is love. It's who he is. The Bible tells us that there is one God. Hear, O Israel, listen up. There's one God all the way throughout. There is one God. But when you get beyond the limits of the physical universe, when you get beyond what you and I can understand, when we get beyond our creatureliness, because we are creatures, we are created beings, we're not gods. When you get beyond all of that, there is in the limitless eternity a God who is more than we can imagine. And here we go. There is one God, but there is more to the one in the one. What does that mean? It means that there is love flowing between Father, Son, and Spirit. What exactly was God doing before there was anything else? I'll tell you what he was doing. He was loving. It's one of my favorite quotes. I take you back to this every now and then. Scott McKnight in his book, The Jesus Creed, puts it like this. The Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit were in an endless dance of endless love and surging joy and delightful play as they enjoyed the depth of their love for one another. They were doing this forever and are doing this now and will do this for eternity. We don't think of God that way, but God is enjoying loving. God is love. This is at the core of everything. If you want to understand the prayer that we're now going to look at, remember this. God gave his Son because he loved. The Son obeyed the Father because he loved. The Spirit served the Son because he loved. The Son champions the Spirit because he loved. God, the Father, blesses the Son. The Spirit is grieved when he sees the Son on the cross. Why? Because of love. All of this is because of love. And it's all heading to the cross. This had to happen, gang. There are two ways that your life can go, and I just need to tell you this. I know I'm coming at you hot. But your existence will stretch out into eternity beyond what you and I can understand. You can either spend that eternity with God or not. I'm imploring you to consider life with God, and it's the cross that makes things right. I had a friend who wrote me recently. I've been looking for him. I'm not sure if he's here this weekend, but he said, I think we underestimate the effects of the rebellion. Just how much we need redeeming. These are my words, but it feels like the planet is just poisoned with serpent venom. this is not good, and only God can remedy this. And so if you look at this prayer now that Jesus is praying, he says, I'll finish the work. I'm the only one that can do this. I'll finish the work. I'll make things right. But then watch this. He's going to send his followers into this world. Please don't think that the gospel is only about saving you for heaven someday, because right here Jesus says, I'm going to finish the work you gave me, but I'm going to send these fellas into the world. As you sent me, I'm sending them in. You're going to be carriers of grace. You're going to infect the world with a hope that they desperately need. In the language of last week, when we talked about building fortresses and some of us said, you know, we're just kind of afraid and we want to be safe and lock the door behind us, we are not a fearful people. We are a sent people. Now look at what Jesus prays. Father, I'm not asking you to take them out of the world. Keep them in the world. Just protect them. From whom? The evil one. There is an enemy of God who seeks to destroy what God is up to in this world. That bears repeating. There is an enemy of God who is your enemy, who seeks to destroy what God is up to in this world. Doesn't mean you fear him, but be aware of him. And one of the ways he will destroy what God is up to is he'll destroy how we are with each other. Father, protect them, because I'm sending them into the story. I'm sending them into the chaos. Just the same way you sent me, I'm sending them deeper into the story. Protect them, oh yeah, and make them different. They gotta be different from the rest of the world. That's what that whole sanctify business means. It means set apart. So now we need to stop, because some of you need to catch your breath. So here it is. I want you to talk to each other for just a minute. Those of you who are joining us in other places online, you know how to reach us. Talk to each other about this. In this world, we'll give you the question up here, but in this world, what's the best example of people working together? Now, hang out with some people around you. This is an easy question. It's a fun question. Talk to people around you. What's the best example in this world today that you can still see people working together, okay? So go on ahead. You guys know how to reach us. Talk to each other. Invite somebody else into the conversation. Don't let them hang out there alone. All right, we're getting some stuff from the sites. We're getting some stuff from those of you joining us from all the various platforms and around the world. So hello to those of you in Mexico City. So just talk for a second. Anybody here, what's the best example of people working together? Anybody got anything? Okay, all at once, so hang on. Let's work together on this. Who said something? In crisis, can So like any of these disaster things, you see like whole communities and organizations and people work together. It's a beautiful thing in a really bad context. Yeah. International Space Station. Yeah, that takes some coordination, doesn't it? Yeah, that's a miracle, man. Somebody over here was saying something. Yeah. The Olympics. I'm going to get to you in a second. The Olympics. How about this? Just speaking of Olympics.
You're taking Benny's, right?
Who is?
You, 3B, 6C.
Yeah.
Lots of weight.
My friend Mike Foster says that curling is the knitting of Olympic sports.
Line's good. Line's real good.
It's boring but strangely relaxing.
Line's good.
So watch them now.
Whoa.
Line's good.
Line's real good.
All there.
Line's good. Line's good.
Line's real good.
Yep.
Wait, it's not good. Work really hard. All right. You know we won a gold medal in curling, yes? We didn't get a lot of gold medals this time around. And I'm all for world peace, so I don't need to stir anything up here. But Russia gets caught cheating at curling? Did you see that? One of their guys was doping? You need steroids to do this? Come on. Where were we? Oh, yeah, Olympics. Somebody over here has been trying to get an answer in. What did you say? You gave up on it. Okay. Tim, you got anything?
Yeah. There's a bunch of people who've said sports teams, being in the ER, living water missions organizations. One person said a SEAL team.
Yeah, SEAL team, yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Or an orchestra, like a symphony
music. Orchestras are really good. Another one that we've heard is the Chick-fil-A drive-thru. Come on, that is a miracle, isn't it? How do they do that? True story, this week I was trying to grab a bite in an airport in a different city and I see Chick-fil-A. I'm like, oh, these guys are efficient. Apparently, the drive-thru works better. That's all I'm gonna say. Because at this airport, I could have done better in a car but anyway, that's just my problem. So a couple of things that were there though, you say, so a mission organization, things like that. Here's what's been fascinating so far, is that out of all of the answers, the one that has been coming in at the bottom is Christians. Like, I'm sure some of you said something that had to do with Christians working together. But so far, like how many of you said that? And please don't look churchy by going, oh, yes, no, I said that. How many of you, and like each of our, just raise your hands real quickly, because yeah, not many, not many. How come? Shouldn't we be like at the top of everybody's list? Oh, you want an example of how things work in this world together? Christians. How come? Doesn't the world need this? Couldn't we like take the lead? You want to be countercultural? You want to not blend in? What if we took the lead on how to work together? That'd be something, wouldn't it? John chapter 17, verses 20 through 23. Jesus has prayed for himself. It's not the only time tonight he will. He prays for those disciples that are with him. And then looking through the corridors of time, he prays for those who will come to believe in this resurrected Lord. Look at what he says. My prayer is not for them alone. Now that's the disciples, but I also pray for those who will believe in me through their message. That's many of us. That all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I and them and you and me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. There's an awful lot in here, but Jesus is praying for something. You see, no matter how big and messy and beautiful and textured the Jesus movement gets in the coming centuries, and it does, and we celebrate, I mean, the truth is every tribe, tongue, and nation, there will be people who worship this Jesus. This is how we began the day. This is a beautiful thing. But no matter how big and messy that gets, Jesus says something really personal and intimate. I want them to be one. I want them to have unity. Now, this isn't some kind of, you know, feel good, can't we all just get along sort of unity. This is something, this has a bite to it. There's a kind of thing that's going to be resilient here. Jesus is praying something. He's not praying, Father, may they be creative, may they be relevant, may they be cool, may they be powerful, may they be wealthy. He doesn't pray any of those things. On the worst night of his life, when time is of the essence, Jesus prays, may they be unified, may they be one. Now, what does it mean to be one? Well, that's an awful lot, and that's a big question. For those of you who are reading a companion book, those of you who are in small groups who are doing this together, I've been talking with you all weekend long, I would say right now, because we're kind of going over chapter one, I would definitely spend some time in chapters 2 and 3. Those of you in small groups, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. You'll encounter a Hebrew word and an ancient Hebrew prayer, which begins to unlock all of this. But for us, let's put it this way. The world is fractured. We've begun to see evidence of that. We're not getting along. People are saying we gotta do something about it. So what do we do? Well, depending on who you talk to, people will say things like, we need better education. People need to know how to do things better. The world is changing, they need a different skill set. So it's about grade schools and high schools. It's about business schools and med schools and tech schools. We need people to just know better skills. It's education. Some people will say it's a matter of systems. Our systems just need to get better. Our government needs to work better. Some people will say we need a healthcare system. Some people will say we need to look at our criminal justice system. We need our systems to be better and more productive and more effective. Some people will say it's all about economics. We need people to be able to provide for themselves. People need to be able, what dignity, it's a beautiful thing when it's like, yes, I'm taking care of my family. We need to make sure that there are ways for people to provide for themselves. Some folks go down the whole human potential angle, and you'll hear kind of that, you know, that rah-rah thing of we need to maximize human potential. We're not living up to our potential. We need to do that. Others will say it's a justice issue. There are wrongs that need to be righted. Some will say it's about the environment or it's about health. We need to make sure that we're taking better care of ourselves. All of those things are great. These guys can't even keep up with the answers, but let me tell you something here. None of those things will ultimately heal what is tearing apart the human soul. I mean, they're all really important, and I think they're a part of the answer, but none of those things will heal what's wrong with the human story. Now, gang, I want to say this very carefully. Some of us are underestimating the power of God's redemption. Yeah, because some of us just think it's about receiving this gift of Jesus, which is an amazing gift, and then we just kind of hang out and wait for heaven. But I'm telling you that God came to redeem all of it, which means all of these things. God can address all of these things, but you have to understand how he's going to do it. Do you know what we as Christians ought to be focused on? I mean, all of these things you need to be involved in. Some of us are being called to any number of these things, but you want to know what Christians need to pay attention to more than anything else? Some of you aren't going to like this very much. That. Like, really? That's what you spent all your time getting us to that? That's your big thing today? That's the punchline today? When Jesus was asked, can you boil the scriptures down? What does he say? It's two things. Love God, love people. It's love, and it's not this squishy kind of love. Some of you are rolling your eyes now. Now, you have trained yourself in church to not, like, do it physically, but, like, in your brain, your eyes are like rolling back. Ugh. Greg, the problems of the world are worse than this. This isn't about a group hug. You know what you think? We're so cynical about love. Oh my goodness. Come here. I know it's cold and flu season. Wash your hands after we do this, okay? But here, this is what people think I'm talking about. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya, kumbaya. Did anybody bring stuff for s'mores? Because that would be awesome right now. My Lord, kumbaya. How come we're so cynical about love? I'm not talking about this. This is really amazing, guys, but I'm going to have to just break it up because this is not what I'm talking about, okay? All right, so really, seriously, go sit down. So that's it. Christian love is more than you think it is. You and I have been called to something completely different in this world. We've been called to make a difference in this world. If we look back, if historians look back someday and describe the Christians of this era, what will they say about us? Think about that, 200 years in the future. History looks back. What do they say about the Christians of this era? That we were more connected than anybody else, that we have better technology, that we were savvy in using the technology of the day, that we were the most powerful Christians, the wealthiest Christians, the loudest Christians. All of those may be true. But will they use the word love? You see, we're really good on some of these things, like doctrine. We're the most informed Christians in the world because we have all of this information at our fingertips. But is that it? Nothing wrong with doctrine. Nothing wrong with orthodoxy. Can I quote Billy Graham here this weekend? I hope you're learning a little bit of the life and the legacy of what it's like for somebody to just do the right thing for a long time. One of my favorite quotes from Dr. Graham was this: the one badge of Christian discipleship is not orthodoxy, but love. There's nothing wrong with orthodoxy. But if you're going to wear a badge, the badge is love. So this week I was with some folks, and one friend reminded another friend at dinner to tell us some stories about Dr. Graham because they were friends. And when I say they were friends, I mean every time he was in this particular city, Dr. Graham stayed with this man. So he's got real stories, right? He starts telling these stories, and it's like, wow, you win. I went to two crusades and I was in the same room. There was like 8,000 feet between us, but that's all I got. He said, I picked him up at the airport one day. This is years ago. We were going to a university in Texas. He was going to speak. I get him there. Everybody inside is waiting for the great Billy Graham. But before we go inside, he takes me by the hand and says, Malcolm, let's go this way. And they go down to the end of the building where there's a landscaping crew just planting and doing their thing over here. And he gets down there and he begins to ask them questions about who they are and what they are and what they're doing. And then he begins to connect kingdom dots. So what you're doing isn't just making this more beautiful. You are, but you're a part of what's going on in the rest of this university. In fact, in the coming years, people will walk through the doors of that building. And because of their experience at this university, people will come to Christ in the coming years. But you need to know you are a part of all of that right now. And I just wanted to thank you. You know what that is? I mean, you could call that great leadership. You could call that humility. You know what that is? That's love. Do you have any idea how healing that is? If Jesus knows what he's talking about, and I believe he does, then why do we treat this so casually? Why do we roll our eyes? Why do we think it's too soft? I'm not saying that this is the end of debate, nor should it be. I'm not even saying that this is the end of conflict and friction between fellow followers of Jesus. Gang, that's always going to happen, but I am telling you there is a different way to do this. If the king of the universe that a whole bunch of us worshiped a minute ago, if the name at which every knee will bow says this matters to him, how come it doesn't matter to us? When you and I gossip, when you and I write stories about somebody and we don't have the whole story, when you and I like knowingly nod our head when we hear something, maybe it's in person, maybe it's online, but when we take the bait and go, I knew it, and then we pass something along, when we hold people in disregard just because they're a little bit different than us, when we say something behind somebody's back, when we make a face behind somebody's back, when we think because we're involved at school or on the team or at work or maybe even here at church, that gives us the right to always have the snarky comment for somebody else. We all lose. Do you understand? The world is watching. I know not all of you are believers. So let me just voice this for you. There are people in each of our rooms, I believe, who are thrown by the way we treat each other. It's not just slightly wrong, it's hellish. And the great name of Jesus takes it on the chin when people who call themselves believers act this way. It doesn't matter how strong your theological arguments are. It doesn't matter which translation of the Bible you read or where you stand on some political issue. If we don't take this prayer seriously, we are no different from anyone else. And the world says, not interested. So what do we do? We're going to do something really awkward now. Painful. I'm going to ask you to pray. We're not finished. We're going to have a little fun here at the end, but I'm going to ask you to pray right now. I'm going to ask you to ask God what you need to do, not what somebody else needs to do. God, what am I hanging on to? What's incomplete that I need to go back and try again? God, I want to be a bridge builder, not a destroyer of bridges. God, forgive me. God, show me. Would you bow your heads? Just, I've got to shut up and get out of your way. Father, I'm absolutely convinced there is that revolution of grace we talk about that could begin, and it could begin right here in this church, on these campuses, the folks who are joining us around the country and the world. God, it could begin with us. Help us to remember today just how much this matters to you. May we be in awe of your love. But God, may we be a little bit undone
but what you're calling us to do. God, help us, please. We need you. Amen. There's a better way. You see, we've been called into this dance, into this love. We who accept this gift of grace have been baptized in this love, soaked through and through. And we will continue to learn what it is to be loved, but we will continue to learn what it is to love. That's our calling. And we get to help God change the world. Because that's what Jesus is praying. The world was on his mind. Father, may my people do this differently so that the world will know that you sent me. That's the plan all along. And we can do this. We are called to this. We're not perfect. If you jump into this with us, it is the most winsome thing. But it's not easy. It's just better. That's all. I'm meeting with a group of leaders this week who are, they're so resourced, they're so clever, they're so smart, they're so motivated, they're so everything. I mean, you look at these people and you go, you could change the world. And they're in a space right now where I believe they're going to, in fact, they're already being asked by other organizations, not Christian organizations, how do you do what you do? I think that is only going to continue. And here's what I told them. It's not because some of you are wealthy, but they are. It's not because you're really smart, but they are. It's not because you are so connected, even politically, and they are. It's not because they're thinking all of this through, even though they are. What I told them was, the reason people are going to come to you is that you have something they don't. There was a phrase in that prayer where Jesus said, Father, I'm giving them the glory that you gave me. It's a really interesting thing there, but most scholars think what he's talking about is the presence of God. You see, it used to be that the glory of God was in the temple, but now after Jesus, you have God in you. I looked at those people and said, it's not because of all of these other things that you're gonna change the world. You know what it is? You have the Spirit of God coursing through your veins. You can do this. Other people won't even be able to put their finger on why you're different, but you can do this. Gang, that's us. We can do this. It's not a matter of maximizing our potential. It's a matter of understanding and remembering God has called us to this. Whew. So, the low card principle. You guys remember that? Seriously? I told you to remember that. Do you remember that? Put the sign back up here. Let's just help them. There, you remember that? It's the exchange principle. One more time. Every contact leaves a trace because an exchange happens. Remember? So the reason I know about this is because of a TED Talk that John Sutherland did in London a while back. It became sort of viral, and you can go look it up for yourself. But the truth is, what Sutherland, a former London police officer and head of London police officers, says is he explains the low card principle, and then the reason this whole thing went viral is he then applies it to our relational world. You see, every contact in your life, in your day, leaves a trace. With strangers, with friends, with enemies, with rivals, with people you're really doing life with well, and people that you're not even really sure where you stand with them. Every contact leaves a trace. You can shake a hand, you can withdraw. You can listen, you can walk past. You can offer grace when it looks like somebody's in a hurry, or you can write a story. You can bless, or you can curse. But every contact leaves a trace. You still with me? We've been called to leave a trace. Now, next week, you're gonna learn how we're going to love in a very specific way those outside the walls of this church, and I hope you join us for that one. Wow, is this going to be interesting the next 2 weeks? A little mini series inside this series. I hope you can keep up with your kids. The youth will be learning about this week, right? So you just try to keep up, okay? But this is something that we've never done this before, all right? But for now, can we remember how much this matters to Jesus? And you go, well, I don't even know what to do with that. Well, we're going to continue to give you strategies and ways to connect with other people around here. But I'm going to give you something right now. Here it is, and we've left time for this. Here it is. You ready?
I want us to end the service differently. We did this months ago. We're going to do it again. Some of you, the worst moment at a service is when I leave you hanging. You've come up to me and said, please don't make me go and think or pray or talk to God. I just want you to tie it up in a nice bow and then I don't have to think about it. So when I leave you hanging and say, yeah, go, do, I watch so many of you, and I'll bet it happens at the site. I'll bet it happens in the hub. You know what it is? You get out of here. And the best way for you to get out of here is to not make eye contact. I'll get the car, you get the kids, let's go. I watch it happen every week. But if Jesus meant what he said, and if he knows what he's talking about, and if every contact leaves a trace, then here we go. I'm gonna ask you, if you would, to not rush out. I'm gonna ask you to meet the people around you and ask the story and go a little bit deeper than you didn't get to. Make plans for lunch, make plans to get together, invite somebody to your small group. At the very least, would you look around and see the people standing next to you who are made in the image of God Almighty and glory in what he is doing, because we've been called to do this together. Now, it's your call how you handle this, but every contact leaves a trace. So you guys just stand, we're done, but I'm gonna ask if you would to do a meet and greet at the end of the service. There's no more offerings, there's no more announcements. Those of you who are watching online, I'm gonna join you over here. Make eye contact, we'll see you.